Thank you and good afternoon and welcome to the 2014 Olin Lecture. We are in for a real treat this afternoon. So I'm pleased to welcome not only, you can applaud after they do it if it's that good, I think it will be. I'm pleased to welcome not only the big audience here in Bailey, but also the virtual audience joining us by live streaming. After 4 years, I've learned how to say that. That's great. The Olin Lecture was established, as many of you know, in 1986 by the Spencer T. and Ann W. Olin Foundation, and it has become not only a highlight of reunion weekend, but a highlight of Cornell's year this year and every year. And this year, we are proud to present not one, but two of our superb, most beloved faculty members. Professors Isaac Kramnik and Glenn Altshuler have a lot in common. Both have taught at Cornell for many years, Professor Kramnik since 1972 and Professor Altshuler since 1981. Both teach some of the most popular courses at Cornell, and each has received multiple teaching awards. And they have collaborated on a book that I'll be very excited to see when it comes out from Cornell University Press this fall. Its title, Cornell, A History, 1940 to 2015. And the authors are here today to enlighten us about what Cornell professors, staff, and students have been doing during these 75 years leading up to our sesquicentennial. But first, a little more about these two individuals who have already done so much for Cornell and for our students over the years. Glenn Altshuler is the Thomas and Dorothy Litwin Professor of American Studies and Dean of the School of Continuing Education and Summer Sessions. He earned his PhD in American History here at Cornell in 1976 and joined the faculty 5 years later, going on to play a crucial role in developing our excellent American Studies program. He is the co-author or author of 10 books and more than 800 essays, reviews, and opinion pieces in venues ranging widely from scholarly journals to the Huffington Post, the Boston Globe, and American Heritage magazine. He has been Dean of Continuing Education and Summer Sessions for 23 years and also served with great distinction as Vice President for University Relations for 4 of those years. And he is currently chair of the Sesquicentennial Steering Committee. Despite his demanding administrative roles, Professor Altshuler has always made teaching and advising his top priorities. His popular culture in the United States from 1900 to the present is one of the most popular courses in the entire university. He has won the Clark Teaching Award, the Paul Award for Excellence in Advising, and the Carpenter Memorial Advising Award. And in 2006, he was named a Stephen H. Weiss Presidential Fellow, Cornell's most prestigious award for undergraduate teaching. Isaac Kramnik is also a remarkable teacher who has been honored as a Weiss Presidential Fellow. Educated at Harvard and Cambridge, he taught at Harvard, Brandeis, and Yale before coming onto the Cornell faculty. He is the Richard J. Schwartz Professor of Government and an expert in English and American political thought and history. He has written or edited 20 books, including a study of Edmund Burke, an edition of the Federalist Papers, and Bolingbroke and His Circle, which won the Conference of British Studies Prize for Best Book on British Politics. His scholarly achievements have been recognized by his election as a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. In addition to the Weiss Fellowship, Professor Kramnik has received a Clark Teaching Award and was once heralded by student ballot as the favorite professor of the year. Professor Kramnik has also served the university as Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education and Faculty Elected Trustee, and he is now, like Professor Altshuler, deeply involved as a member of the Sesquicentennial Steering Committee. After 50 years of university teaching, 43 of them at Cornell, Professor Kramnik will retire in June 2015 to go on to new activities. And so now I'm going to turn the stage over to Professors Altshuler and Kramnik and take a seat to enjoy being a student again. This, in my mind, is a reunion bonus, a return to the classroom with two of Cornell's most outstanding faculty and not a test in sight. Please welcome Professors Altshuler and Kramnik.
For those of you who don't know me, I'm Glenn Altshuler. In fact, for those of you who do know me, I'm also Glenn Altshuler. Thank you so much, President Skorton, for the honor you've bestowed on us with the invitation to deliver this prestigious lecture. Your kind words this afternoon are especially welcome because we know that introductions are not always so generous. Some years ago, for example, the eminent and eminently cantankerous Professor Oscar Handlin introduced one of our colleagues to a large audience at Harvard as follows. Stuart Blumen thinks he knows something about American urban history. We'll see. With that sobering reminder, we want to share some reflections about the way we were and are at Cornell. In his commencement address in June 1960, with his tongue tucked in his cheek, President Malott imagined the return of the class of 1960 for its 40th reunion in the year 2000. You will reminisce about your long ago student days, the president predicted, contrasting travel on the old Lehigh Valley Railroad with the now routine trips back to Ithaca in rocket capsules. No one will be overweight because Cornell's Graduate School of Nutrition and Cornell Medical College in New York City will have helped you eliminate obesity. You will express shock at the tuition announced for the year 2001. But, Malott said, I shall not disturb the equanimity of the occasion by giving voice to the actual amount, because your sons and daughters will have graduated from Cornell before the new century began. You will be startled to hear, Malott announced, that the president is anti-fraternity, the result of a policy enacted in 1981 to defer rushing to the sophomore year under a tentative plan developed by the Interfraternity Council to be reappraised after a brief 100-year trial. Malott declared as well that the 1960 graduates would perhaps be less surprised to hear that the Cornell Daily Sun had been campaigning vigorously against the administration because of the use of immature and unintelligent pigs for experimental purposes. Yes, times will have changed, the president acknowledged, but he urged his audience to remember that Cornell was born of protest to existing stuffy order of the 19th century academic institutions. It will be a tragic day, Malott concluded, when students are no longer willing to probe and explore and to innovate and to experiment. As President Malott suggested, Cornell's student body is best understood as changing and changeless. It remains, for example, the most democratic ivy. For this reason, in fact, we do not look like we once looked. At the end of World War II, and when Cornell celebrated its centennial in 1965, students were mostly male. Almost all of them were white. The class of 2017 is much more diverse. Some 16% are Asian, 12% Hispanic, 7% African American. More than 2% are biracial or multiracial. 11% are international students. Women constitute a sizable percentage and often a majority in every college at Cornell. Like their counterparts in every generation, millennial students exhibit a wide array of tastes and temperaments. But since, rightly or wrongly, Cornell retains its reputation as a pressure cooker, virtually all of them study a lot. They crowd into Eurus, hunker down in the Olin Stacks, set up shop in the Green Dragon in Sibley, or in a classroom on the first floor of Goldwin Smith, which is always unlocked. Wanting to see and be seen, they have become adept at the practice known for 30 years as FaceTime. A low attrition rate, 96% of first-year students return for their sophomore year, has not relieved anxiety. Neither has grade inflation. About 40% of all grades are now A's. Oh, come on. Suck it up. C's and D's are endangered species. Since grade inflation is rampant through the rest of the Ivy League as well, students feel they need a leg up on the stiff competition for spots in professional schools and good jobs. In 1994, an ILR professor lamented that students in his class viewed a grade on a paper as, quote, his opening bid. Like their peers at other colleges and universities, we regret to report a significant number of Cornell students cheat. There has been much in the media about the current generation of students as the generation of cheaters. In the internet age, cheating may well be even more pervasive and difficult to detect. But, and I'm not looking at any one of you individually, Cornell students have always cheated. Let your conscience be your guide. There are religious services where you can confess this evening. We found a Cornell Sun poll in 1955 with 50% of students acknowledging that they cheated. More recently, a survey documented the extent of academic dishonesty at Cornell and the various forms it takes. 10% said they changed an answer on a returned exam and then asked for a regrade. 11% indicated they used a cheat sheet in an exam. 25% asked a classmate to look at their answers. 32% said they made up an excuse to get an extension. 33% plagiarized. 37% shared the contents of an exam with a friend before he or she sat for it. 72% worked on a lab report, problem set, or term paper with another student without the permission of the instructor. And that's only in Professor Kramnik's courses. And drinking remains a staple of the work hard, play hard Cornell culture, in contrast to your day. We know less about drug use, though we suspect that with the exception of marijuana, it is less prevalent than it was in the 1960s and 70s. Students drink to forget stress, lower inhibitions, and quite often because their friends drink and they can't come up with anything better to do. Things changed a bit, as some of you know, on December 1st, 1985, when New York State raised the minimum age for the purchase of alcohol to 21. Duffy's Tavern closed in 1986. I know. Johnny's Big Red, Grill, where Peter Yarrow sang, Harry Chapin got his first gig, Richard Farina was a regular, and Vladimir Nabokov, rumor had it, once lived upstairs, soon followed. Although its neon sign, which the city of Ithaca has given landmark status, stayed up. And the chapter house began inviting students to drown their sorrows in fruit juice. Nonetheless, students have found ways to get high above Cayuga's waters. Surveys indicated that about 85% of students drink, about 20% of them fitting the definition of heavy drinkers. They drink in residence halls, and despite vigorous efforts by university officials, in fraternity and sorority houses, at tailgating parties outside Schoolkopf Field, and on Slope Day. Drunk or sober, many students devote a great deal of time to hanging out and hooking up. Quick sexual encounters with roommates, friends, and lovers. Public manifestations of affection are much more in evidence these days. As in the past, however, students prefer to live up or down to Cornell myths, musts, and modes of operation, and on occasion, to introduce new ones. There is and always has been a lot to do on this campus. There are hundreds of clubs with scores of new ones appearing every year. In an alumni news story about her graduating class, Diane Catcher Blatter, class of 78, claimed in 1 week she had heard a lecture on Polish poetry, attended a class in Japanese no dancing, listened to a reading by Allen Ginsberg, jumped on a trampoline, taken a wine tasting test, camped out near Cayuga Lake, and joined a political protest at the Strait. Acknowledging that she was, quote, romanticizing, diving heartfirst into sentimentality, Blatter brushed aside, quote, Cornell's bureaucracy, its lack of compassion, computerized registration forms, racial tensions, pre-professional grinding, and competition to confess, I loved it here. I did. Mark Schwartz, from the great class of 1984, told the Cornell Daily Sun that you are not a true Cornellian unless you climb to the top of the clock tower, tromp through the apple orchards, swim in the gorges, and take a seemingly irrelevant course. Surprisingly, perhaps, his list did not include throwing fish on the ice or tying a chicken to the net during a Cornell-Harvard hockey game. In Changing and Changeless Cornell, students said goodbye to some traditions and invented new ones. In 2000, Bob Petrilla sold his hot truck, a name chosen to differentiate his menu, PMP, or Poor Man's Pizza, and MCB, Meatball and Cheese, which used French bread from his father's restaurant, to Albert Smith, class of 71, owner of the Shortstop Deli in downtown Ithaca. In 2006, students, and many of you, bid farewell to Walter Lefebvre, a fabled teacher, scholar, and mentor at the university since 1959, whose History of American Foreign Policy course, taught on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays, attracted hundreds of students who applauded at the end of every lecture, delivered impeccably and without notes. Among the new traditions and additions to university lore was the appearance in the dark hours of October 7th to 8th, 1997, of what appeared to be a hollowed-out pumpkin on top of the McGraw Tower spire, 173 feet above the ground. Amid speculation about who done it and how did they do it, Andy Pearson, class of 01, declared it was aliens. President Hunter Rawlings quipped that standing on his tiptoes, he had done it himself. With the mystery still unsolved, we ask that the perpetrator, who we know is in this audience, identify himself or herself. In the 21st century, Cornell students are less interested in political causes than were their counterparts in the 60s and 70s, though they are most certainly more engaged than undergraduates in the first 100 years of the university's existence. Of course, the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon on September 11, 2001 commanded the attention of everyone on campus. There was a gathering in the Arts Quad, the largest gathering apart from commencement ceremonies in the institution's history. And in the fall of 2005, Cornell students played a leading role in welcoming students from Tulane University, Dillard University, Xavier University, and the University of New Orleans, all of which had been forced to close their doors following the devastation visited in New Orleans by Hurricane Katrina. Our image of the cutthroat Cornell student has vanished over the past few days, said Tulane undergraduate Lindsay Oliver. You tell them from you're from Tulane, and everything changes. In the absence of a disaster, however, activists found it difficult to mobilize large numbers of students and command the attention of the campus for more than a few days. In March 2003, for example, about 200 students opposing the impending war in Iraq marched through a dozen buildings on campus before rallying at Day Hall. At the end of the month, conservative students, who have been much more visible and vocal at Cornell since the 1980s, when the Cornell Review was founded as the self-proclaimed conservative voice on campus, countered with a rally on Hope Plaza to express support for President Bush's decision to remove Saddam Hussein from power. Chair of the Cornell Republicans, Ryan Horn, declared that the vast majority of students are patriotic people and they support the troops in the field. As the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq wore on, however, Cornell students have seldom rallied against them. There is nothing like the protests or the political theater one found on campus in the Vietnam era. In the presidential election of 2012, for example, there were no speeches or rallies by Cornell Republicans or Democrats in front of the Strait at lunchtime. As many of you have noticed, the stump is dead. Student activists had somewhat better luck enlisting support for environmental causes with local implications. Students Against Sweatshops have pressed the administration to eliminate sweatshop labor. A coalition of students, faculty, and community activists, the Red Bud Woods Working Group, fought for years, unsuccessfully, to be sure, to prevent nearly 3 acres, dubbed Red Bud Woods, from becoming a parking lot to serve West Campus students. We have a Cornell branch of Kyoto now that has pressed President Skorton on a range of issues. And in May 2013, 24 students staged a die-in in front of Day Hall to dramatize the potential consequences of fossil fuel-induced global warming. For the last 30 years, identity politics has attracted the sustained attention of more students than any other cause. Indeed, it has taken hold with greater force and ferocity in colleges and universities than in other institutions in the United States. Calling attention to the limitations of research and teaching focused exclusively on the achievements of great white men, many professors have contributed to the dominance of identity politics. The emphasis on society, history, and culture from the perspective of previously silenced men and women has also been used to expose what some view as the flaws at the core of American society. For students, many of whom are teenagers, in the process of forming a stable sense of self, the appeal of identity politics, with its self-confirming dynamic and its demand for recognition and respect, is self-evident. Having been told they were nobodies, Todd Gitlin, the Columbia University sociologist, has noted, they were now in a position to insist that they were somebodies. Administrators who recoiled at the prospect of unrest, protest, violence, and bad publicity, and endorsed affirmative action as a worthy principle and policy, found identity politics hard to resist, except when it seemed to be turning groups into fortified enclaves, hardening into separation, and attracting unfavorable and unwanted public scrutiny. Identity politics has been a fact of life at Cornell for decades. Ethnic studies programs proliferated. Administrators struggled to comply with Title IX prohibitions against discrimination on the basis of sex. The existence of UJMA and random housing assignments for freshmen were hotly debated and continue in some measure to be hotly debated now. In the 1980s and 90s, Hispanic students took over Day Hall. Their leader, Eduardo Penalver, who went on to be a Rhodes Scholar and a distinguished law professor, has just been named the dean of the Cornell Law School. Aguego, you may applaud. One man's enlightenment is another man's chagrin. Aguego, a Mohawk word meaning all of us, the American Indian House on North Campus opened its doors. Jewish students got a kosher dining hall. A program in Asian American studies was launched. Identity politics certainly played a role in Hunter Rawlings' decision to house all freshmen on North Campus. And gay students, pointing to the recent establishment of a Latino Living Center, demanded that space be set aside for gays, lesbians, and bisexuals. In 2013, the university established a Muslim cultural center. That fall, for the first time in Cornell's history, students in on-campus housing were permitted to have a roommate of another gender. Of 3,340 undergraduates who signed up for the residential lottery, 26 opted for gender-inclusive housing on West Campus. All of them chose gender-inclusive suites, not gender-inclusive rooms. Students, faculty, and administrators, in our judgment, have not been very good at discussing the implications, positive and negative, of identity politics. Witness, for example, the recent firestorm over the decision to shift the Africana Studies and Research Center from the administrative oversight of the provost's office to that of the College of Arts and Sciences. The public statements on all sides, we believe, cited good reasons, but not always the real reasons, for the positions that they were taking. And Cornell continues to struggle to find ways of establishing and supporting additional communities to complement what we consider to be the legitimate place of ethnicity, race, and gender in identity. To make the whole more than the sum of its parts, institutions and societies can, and in our judgment, should, maintain a healthy tension between a host of overlapping interest-based affinities and loyalties, identity rooted in an individual's background, and the common weal, the community, and the common good. But it isn't easy. At Cornell, as elsewhere, identification with one's graduating class has declined. And the freshman beanie, along with hazing of first-year students, thank God, has disappeared. Intercollegiate sports does not bring the Cornell community together as it did in the 1940s and 50s, and still does at Duke and Michigan. The building blocks of bonding with fraternity and sorority brothers and sisters are undergoing what we view as a long overdue reevaluation. And Slope Day is not our idea of one Cornell at its best. Dragon Day comes a lot closer. Cornell's experimental common learning initiative, started by the incomparable Frank Rhodes, to combat specialization and provide general education courses to help students with varying backgrounds and viewpoints better understand common questions, values, social priorities, and global concerns, alas, did not endure. For about a decade, the Book Project has aspired to help first-year students who now share the same living space come together around a common intellectual experience. Far more ambitious, of course, is the West Campus system, which brings faculty and students together in intellectual and social communities, and importantly, at meals. In an initiative designed as a landmark opportunity to enhance fundamentally the undergraduate experience at Cornell and provide another positive source of identity. We ask that you stay tuned along with us to see how it all works out. Many Cornell students, it's worth emphasizing, are indifferent or even hostile to identity politics. Lots of them probably do not think all that much about a Cornell whole that is greater than the sum of its parts. Indeed, as we have implied, the diversity of backgrounds, values, and views among Cornell students is a source of strength and pride, even though it makes it tough for observers like us to generalize about them. But generalizations we have made, and we conclude with a few more based largely on our own observations. Students, faculty, and alumni at Cornell have a lot to be proud of. The Sierra Club recently designated Cornell as one of its top 10 coolest schools. Voting with their feet and their application fees, tens of thousands of high school students have deemed Cornell to be one of the hottest schools in America. At the end of March, Cornell accepted 14% of more than 43,000 applicants to the class of 2018. We've done a careful calculation of your SAT scores and grades, and 9 of you would have been accepted. The names are posted in our book. students are better traveled and much more religious. Openly religious Christians, Jews, and Muslims abound on campus today. They are more politically conservative and socially liberal, and in some ways are more sophisticated than those who came before them. Gay marriage, for example, is not an issue on this campus. Students tend as well to be quite close to their parents. The revolutions in technology, with its cell phones, emails, text messages, and Facebook posts, help, of course. But so do the attributes of parents, who are less inhibited, more sexually liberated, more open, and more permissive than many of your parents. On the other hand, today's students, in our judgment, are more brittle than students we have taught in the past. Accustomed to praise and high grades, they do not take criticism all that well. Nor do they read and write as much or as well as those who came before them. Concerned about and at times obsessed with their career prospects, they spend lots of time applying for internships, revising resumes and cover letters, choosing practical courses, a minor in business, a double and triple major, because they will look good to professional school admissions committees and or employers. On the other hand, Cornell students are generous, compassionate, and committed to public service. As many of you know, Cornell sends more students to the Peace Corps, Teach for America, and similar organizations than all but a handful of universities in the United States. They give the lie to the claim that this generation is selfish and self-serving. In 1965, at the celebration of Cornell's centennial, Morris Bishop, class of 1918, professor of Romance Studies and university historian, who knew Andrew D. White when Bishop was an undergraduate, reflected on the university's, quote, march toward the realization of Ezra Cornell's dream to become a university of the first magnitude, a foremost seat of learning in America. Noting that no one in the audience would be present at this bicentennial celebration of 2065, Bishop expressed confidence that the work of Cornell undergraduates, graduate and professional students, alumni and faculty, quote, will then be called to account. You too will be part of history. And he ventured to hope that a speaker on that Charter Day celebration in 2065, quote, will confirm my words today, that there can be no great creation without a dream, that giant towers rest on a foundation of visionary purpose, that our realities are at bottom spiritual. We are now halfway between 1965 and 2065. As I yield the podium to Isaac Kramnik, my colleague, collaborator, and best friend, I can think of no more fitting end to this discussion of students than to affirm with Professor Bishop that it is our solemn duty to bring the dreams of Ezra Cornell and Andrew White, quote, to earth, to house them in stone, to plant them in the spirits of the teachers and the taught, and to look forward and not back, and without forgetting old wisdom, to seek wisdom ever new to prepare an ever greater Cornell.
tough act to follow. But I'll try. I want to thank President Skorton, first for inviting us to give this Olin lecture. We were both deeply honored when he asked us to do this, and secondly, to thank him for the lovely and kind words of his introduction of me. It is my pleasure and honor to have been a faculty member of this great university for all these decades now, into my fifth decade as a professor here. So speaking of faculty, that is my segue. Let me turn now in our talk to a discussion of the faculty, where there has been change as well as continuity over these past 50 years. But I should say, by way of warning, that my friends think that I can sometimes seem a little cranky, often telling stories with internal contradictions, never describing a favorable change without mentioning its less appealing shadowed side. On the one hand, this, on the other hand, that. I confess to this problem or defect in my character. I like to make history complicated, more complicated, since it seems to me history is often complicated. For example, the faculty. The faculty are certainly more diverse on the one hand, but on the other hand, the faculty is not diverse enough. In the 1960s and 1970s, professors at Cornell were virtually all men, with the exception of a relatively large number of women faculty in the College of Home Economics, renamed the College of Human Ecology in 1968. Today, there are certainly many more women faculty, but still only 28% of the faculty are women and 72% are men. At the same time, faculty, I'm glad to say, are no longer all white. Just slightly over 80% are, with 7% African American or Hispanic American and 9% Asian American. As elsewhere in American professional life, there are many more openly gay faculty here now than were here when you were here. In terms of their politics, faculty are still, as they were when you were students, fairly liberal, though it varies as it did then by college. Arts College, ILR, and human ecology faculty more so than ag and engineering faculty, and certainly more so than hotel and business. There are a few outspoken conservatives on campus, probably more than in your years, but still very few. And one final point about who the faculty today are at Cornell, and it is an important one. Virtually none of them are adjuncts. A good deal of public attention is now being given in the press to the increasing numbers of colleges which hire less expensive part-time faculty to teach courses, creating a kind of underclass professoriate. Cornell, like the rest of the Ivy League, has virtually no adjunct faculty, and that is good. So to summarize, there has been change in who the faculty are, but no great change. The Cornell faculty is still mainly men, mainly white, mainly straight, and mainly left of center. Where there has been a truly dramatic change is in what these faculty do, in what faculty life is like at Cornell and at all elite research universities which have a distinguished faculty. The traditional role of faculty in places like Cornell, one that has been mythologized in books and movies like Goodbye, Mr. Chips, was firstly mentoring students. Faculty provided counsel and advice as these young people confronted the new personal career and life choices that came with adult emancipation. Personal time with professors in office hours provided the life coaching for earlier generations of students. To be sure, this view of professors is somewhat the product of nostalgia, as well as the way things were. By the way, let me interject why we chose that title, The Way We Were and Are. You may remember, and I'll say this quickly, you may remember in 1973 there was a movie called The Way We Were with Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford. It was written, the screenplay was written by Arthur Laurent, class of 31 Cornell. And the beginning of the movie, which is about how Redford and Streisand meet on a college campus, is from his sense of his memories of Cornell. That's why we chose that title. It's a Cornell title. Okay, back to the traditional roles of faculty. The second traditional role of professors was to be teachers who opened the minds of students to the world of ideas, humanistic and scientific ideas. It was hoped, and to some extent expected, that the Ivy League professor would take the products of America's decidedly uneven public school system and free them from the parochial and conventional wisdom of family, neighborhood, and hometown, opening them to a new world outside themselves and their connections, a world of ideas. No one has better captured these two traditional roles of faculty than Cornell's unofficial poet laureate, E.B. White, class of 1921, the author of Stuart Little, Charlotte's Web, and of course the mainstay of the New Yorker magazine. At Cornell, White, a brother of Phi Gamma Delta and editor-in-chief of the Cornell Sun, had a particularly close relationship with his English professor, Bristow Adams, who lived across the Fall Creek Gorge in Cornell Heights. This is what White wrote about his beloved mentor many years later in a 1957 letter to Professor Adams's widow, in which he reminisced about his college years. I quote, "Those first years at Cornell were lonely ones for me. The pages of my diary are full of homesickness and other sorrows. But at your house, I found relief. And in that upstairs sitting room, B.A., Bristow Adams, dispensed a good deal more than entertainment and coffee. I guess it was his knack of treating a young man as a companion rather than as an oddity that made all the difference. I remember so well how good it was for the ego, the spirit, and even the intellect. I used to walk back across the suspension bridge at midnight, feeling all smoothed out and peaceful. Oh, those nights at the Adamses." End of quote. And here is how White captured the second role of faculty, opening their minds to the world of ideas. Late in his life, E.B. White wrote of a class with a Cornell historian, and this is what he wrote. "I wasn't particularly interested in the Middle Ages, but I was trying to get an education and was willing to listen to almost anything. The professor was a little odd gentleman named George Lincoln Burr. For the first few days, his class in history seemed pretty much like any other college class. But as Professor Burr talked, something began to happen. Somehow I seemed to be transported into another century, and I began living in the dark days when a few men who still call their souls free were struggling against tyrants and bigots, struggling to preserve what priceless shreds of knowledge and truth the world had at that time managed to scrape together. My chance encounter with George Lincoln Burr was the greatest single thing that ever happened in my life, for he introduced me to a part of myself that I hadn't discovered. I saw with blinding clarity how vital it is for man to live in a free society. The experiences enabled me to grow up almost overnight. It gave me my thoughts and ambitions a focus, for which I shall gladly continue to fight the remainder of my life." Now again, let me remind you that this is the product of nostalgia, of course, as well as the way things were. There were indeed many Bristow Adamses and George Burrs on the Cornell faculty, but many professors in the good old days, including, alas, the great Carl Becker, were neither very good teachers nor all that accessible to students. But the very ideal of what faculty do has been seriously challenged in the last 50 years, and some say has come close to being totally abandoned. Happily, as I will argue in a few moments, this traditional ideal has proved resilient. It is still here, if less mythic, as a description of faculty life. The changes I am about to describe may appear to have produced a paradox, as I suggested, an alteration in faculty interests and practices that seemed bound to threaten the intellectually nurturing role they have traditionally assumed in student life. This threat has not come to pass, while the faculty experience has changed, as I will proceed to describe, the overriding responsibility to students survives and is unchanging. Let me describe first the dramatic changes in the faculty experience this past half century, and then turn to the restorative response. The daily routine activities and priorities of the faculty, when many of you were here, used to be campus-focused. Teaching, advising, research, university committees, faculty meetings. The professor's academic life was grounded here in the classrooms, libraries, and labs of Ithaca. A professor's reputation, fame, and distinction were assessed and judged by students, department colleagues, and by the Cornell Sun. Now, over the years, faculty interests, commitments, and priorities have shifted dramatically to off-campus commitment. As professors, our fame, our rewards, our professional visibility and sense of importance comes today primarily from outside of campus. We are important if we are invited to speak at Duke or Stanford, invited to a conference in Tokyo or Bellagio, or to consult in Washington or Wall Street. Many of us are thus more committed now to an abstract off-campus professional community called chemistry professors or English professors worldwide, and are standing in it and in the national and international organizations of each discipline, much more so than we are to collegial campus-based life as a professor and teacher at Cornell. When I arrived here in 1972, faculty seldom left campus during breaks, except during breaks or vacations, never during term. Now, we will fly off to give a talk, attend a conference, do a consultantship in the middle of term, juggling and rearranging our classes. Some years ago, I used to pose this riddle, and many of you are of an age to understand my reference. The question: why is the Cornell faculty like the airplanes in the Strategic Air Command? Answer: because at any particular time, 25% of them are in the air. Or as I sometimes still say to my students with paradoxical irony, you know you're at a great university because your faculty are not always here. That's a sign of how good they are. If they were always here, it means no one else wants to hear them. Now, lots of factors have contributed to this shifting of faculty expectations, priorities, and focus off campus, and to what I call the rise of the peripatetic professor. Have talk, have consultancy, we'll travel. Most important was the growth of the research university during the Cold War, when government money, mainly from the Defense Department and the National Science Foundation, started pouring into universities for basic research in the natural and social sciences. Faculty priorities and rewards shifted from being a local campus star to fame acquired through publicly acclaimed research. There was new money coming into campuses from grants given by foundations like Ford and Rockefeller, and from private corporations like DuPont and IBM. There was money for higher faculty salaries. No longer were Cornell faculty poorly paid monastics sequestered in Ithaca. There was money for travel that took you to conferences, to lecture colleagues and graduate students at Berkeley or Michigan, and to consult in New York or London, all of which is extremely pleasant. Let me describe for you what happens when you give an important late afternoon lecture on campus to the Cornell community. A few students and a few people from downtown who recognize your name come to the talk. Virtually no colleagues come, and the room is half empty. You finish the talk, and you walk home quietly to the usual dinner with your family. Now let's suppose you give a talk at Duke. You are met at the airport and whisked off to drinks with adoring graduate students who know your research and have read your books. You give a talk packed with students and faculty eager to see the visiting superstar from Cornell. You then go to a sumptuous dinner, again surrounded by the ever-present adoring graduate students, and finally off to sleep in a quiet room in a lovely campus inn. I ask you, what's not to like about off-campus professional life? And by the way, it usually also comes with the modest honorarium, as we call it, of maybe $1,000 for all of your troubles. Now, if faculty today are spending so much time off-campus, something has to give. We have only a finite amount of time. What traditional academic responsibilities do we drop? Cornell's presidents Dean Mallott and James Perkins worried about that even as they presided over Cornell developing into a major research university in the 1950s and 60s. They presciently predicted, as Perkins did in 1966, that, quote, increasingly mobile professors will be attracted to professional and practical life beyond the campus, end quote, and that they would neglect mentoring, advising, and teaching eager students. And they were right. The quality of our classroom instruction remains excellent, but student advising and life mentoring have become a somewhat lower priority for faculty. And this is the cranky me. This vacuum has been filled by the growth of a new professional academic advising staff in each college who do a lot of what professors used to do, advise and mentor students, walk them through their homesickness, help them craft a sound academic schedule, and engage them in career discussions. There are other things the new peripatetic faculty do less of. What tends to be dropped is campus collegial life, by which I mean the extent that faculty guide and shape and even control what happens on campus. The demise of the faculty meeting is one casualty. Arts College faculty meetings, when I came here in 1972, were well attended, often by 300 to 400 of the college's then 600-person faculty. In the tumultuous 1960s and 1970s, during the South African divestment crisis of the 1980s, meetings of cross-college university faculty often had over 1,000 faculty in attendance. These meetings were great theater, with the likes of Mike Abrams and Max Black and Fred Kahn crossing swords with the likes of Alan Bloom and L. Pierce Williams. Today, if you get 50 Arts College professors to come to a meeting, you are lucky, and the issue is probably about faculty parking. The Arts College now, in fact, has most of its important collective decisions not made in face-to-face faculty meetings, for which you never get a quorum, but electronically, in virtual meetings through computer voting, a truly amazing and worrisome development in the depersonalization of campus life. Don't misunderstand me, however. There were and still are important institutional benefits from the new peripatetic faculty model, even as undergraduate advising took the biggest hit. The new model enabled Cornell to acquire and retain one of the most distinguished faculties in the world. And these faculties, whose horizons are international, not local, win Nobel Prizes, Pulitzer Prizes, they win grants, they appear as talking heads on television. They get quoted by other important people, all of which brings glory, honor, and to be sure, favorable public notice and attention to Cornell. At every academic conference around the globe, at every UN meeting on food production, the participating Cornell professor who may be missing class that day is planting the Cornell flag, announcing that Cornell is a player, a major player, a world-class leader in thought, and a world-class leader in the practical application of knowledge. The payoff to the university provided by its traveling peripatetic professors is priceless. But as I assured you when I began, there are also in recent years vital signs of a revised focus of Cornell faculty on their traditional roles of mentoring and enlightening undergraduates. Like this generation of young people, Cornell faculty are good at multitasking. They can be away from campus on occasion and be very student-focused when they are here, which even cranky me has to acknowledge is, of course, most of the time. Let me also lay to rest one canard about research-focused professors, and this is good news. The fear that faculty doing publicly acclaimed research could not be great teachers has proved groundless. The evidence suggests that great Cornell scholars are usually great Cornell teachers who continue to open the minds of students who flock to their classes. Indeed, an argument can be made that teaching is far better today than in the good old days. There is less reliance on the lecture, which even at its best has been shown to be one of the least effective ways to impart knowledge. Altshuler and I ought to know. We are lecture traditionalists who never use PowerPoint, as you can see. Or not see, as is in fact the case. The introduction of audiovisual materials to presentations and homework assignments can enhance learning when carefully integrated with other material. So can the more interactive pedagogies, including clicker technology, which measure comprehension and give instructors feedback in real time. President Rawlings was particularly interested in the Cornell undergraduate experience and was concerned with the impact on it of what I have been describing as new faculty priorities. His response was the Newhouse system on West Campus. In his presidency, the U-Halls that many of you lived in were replaced by five houses, each with their own dining rooms, and each presided over by live-in senior faculty. The very names of the houses, legendary Cornell faculty names from the past, Alice Cook, Carl Becker, Hans Bethe, William Keaton, Flora Rose, signify that it is in these new living arrangements, not in faculty offices, that close faculty-student relationships are more likely to take place. And what is truly amazing is that the faculty, peripatetic as they are flocking to be house professors, following the wonderful pioneer efforts of Ross Brand and Cindy Hazan, and that each week, scores of faculty share meals and conversation with students in the new house dining rooms. Another hopeful sign of a revival of closer faculty-student interaction is the tremendous growth in the number of students doing independent research under individual faculty sponsorship. Each semester, hundreds of undergraduates, mainly in the sciences to be sure, but increasingly in the social sciences and humanities as well, work closely in a shared research relationship with many of the distinguished faculty who on occasion may be out of town. Contact with students outside the classroom is on the rise all over campus. We see the proliferation of teams in the College of Engineering, for example, where faculty work with students to build race cars and energy-efficient homes and enter them into national contests. Look at the phenomenally successful first-year reading project, which Glenn mentioned, which was introduced in 2000 by the then Provost Biddy Martin, now president of Amherst College. It has 3,200 first-year students read a book, usually a novel, over the summer to be discussed in small seminar settings their first weekend at Cornell. What makes this work are nearly 200 faculty who volunteered to read the book over the summer as well, and then lead the discussion sections in late August. These faculty, by the way, come from departments all over the university, from arts, engineering, ILR, hotel, human ecology, agriculture, even business, law, and the vet school. So despite the forces in recent years pulling faculty away from campus life, we still have our fair share, or more than our fair share, of professors who, like Bristow Adams, treat young men and women like companions and colleagues, and leave them, though perhaps not at midnight, feeling smoothed out and peaceful. And we have our fair share, more again than our fair share, of professors like George Brewer, who opened the minds of today's students who, as White said of him, introduced them to a part of themselves waiting to be discovered. The good news, then, is that just as in 1917, when the freshman E.B. White arrived in Ithaca by train, so the new Cornellians today, 100 years later, will still find great teachers. The bad news is that, unlike E.B. White, today's new Cornell students cannot arrive by train. Let me say it proudly. We, the Cornell faculty, young assistant professors, and older traveling academic superstars, still change student lives. And we know this, because like E.B. White, they and you tell us so. I want to share, by way of my conclusion, one of these stories with you about one particular alum who will remain nameless, who wrote to me some years ago after he left Ithaca, particularly thankful to his old professor, Bois, for some help I had provided him. It's an unusual story of the impact I had on the student's life, which still delights me. Before I read this wonderful thank you, professor, email, I need to provide some background quickly. A few years ago, I co-wrote with Larry Moore of our history department a book on church-state relations in America with the title The Godless Constitution. As part of the publicity for the book, I was interviewed one weekend. Larry was out of the country. I was interviewed one weekend on Ira Glass's NPR show, This American Life. Some months later, I received the following email from a former student living in Seattle, thanking me for how I had transformed his life. This is how it reads. Professor Kramnik, do I have a story for you? Whimsically, as I was on my way out the door to catch the bus this morning, I grabbed a copy of The Godless Constitution and put it in my gym bag. After work, I had a date with this girl I met last weekend at the outdoor festival. Anyway, she picked me up at work, and This American Life was on the radio. We're chatting and listening to it in the background, and then all of a sudden, you're in the car with us. I love this. I'm like, wow, that's my college advisor. So it's a great discussion you're giving, and we pull the car into an empty parking lot so we can listen more. Then you start talking about the book, which I produce from my gym bag. It's not often I have such a great in with girls now. I moved to Seattle, and I've been here a year, but outside of work, my social network is still very limited. But I've somehow managed, because I have no shame, to go on a lot of dates that all end up being horrible because I have nothing to talk with the girl about and nothing to bond over, other than the place I met her, usually a bar or the gym. So as a result of the radio program, this girl and I are talking about politics, something you don't do on a first date. And subsequently, the whole evening just went smoothly. We clicked. The first time I've ever had what I call a satisfying conversation on a date since I got here. I'm going out with her again next week. Do you think you can arrange to be on the radio? It does wonders for my social life. So with this rather unusual but happy example of how many other different ways Cornell professors affect the lives of our students, let me now bring an end to Professor Altshuler's and my personal reflections on changes and continuities in Cornell students and faculty over the many years we two have been here. As he pointed out, we have discovered in the research for our book that one very important thing about Cornell has not changed. Cornell began as, and still is, the most egalitarian of elite schools. We are still the Ivy League school with a Big Ten heart. And the members of Cornell's class of 2018 who arrived this fall, one of whom, by the way, is my granddaughter, in this our sesquicentennial. As they arrive here in this our sesquicentennial year, They will forge their identity here just as you did in your 4 years here. They will create a self with the help of a world-class faculty and with all that this historic university community offers. And all this will happen for them as it did for you during that same magical 4-year retreat from the real world that they spend up here on East Hill, far above Cayuga's waters and far above the busy humming of the bustling town. Thank you.
Graciously agreed to take no questions. We have time. You have to talk faster than we talk. So we will take a couple of questions, but they have to be good. We're going to grade the questions. So think before you get up to the microphone. We can embarrass you. We're professors. Anybody? Where? Right up there. Yes, sir.
Shout it out. Thank you very much. What he's remembering is that when I teach political philosophy, and when I got to Edmund Burke, you may remember, I used to link that to being a tortured fan for the Red Sox all my life, because Edmund Burke tells us that internal to all human beings is an innate evil, and of course I always knew from being a Red Sox fan that evil always triumphed, and that. And its name was the New York Yankees. Thank you. Next question. I was thrilled.
You brought us through past the social revolution of the 60s and the telecom revolution 20 years ago. What's going to happen when the university confronts the disruptive technology that's bringing online education?
I'm an historian.
It's a wonderful question, and lots of good people on campus, in the provost's office, in the president's office, and among the faculty are concerned about this and are trying to think this through in terms of the impact of MOOCs and distance learning. It is being noticed and talked about, and there is concern.
This is from a man who wrote drafts of chapters for our book on longhand. On yellow pads. What the hell do you know about what we're going to do in the future?
But wait a minute. It's got to be said on yellow pads, but I did use a mechanical pencil. Next question.
Any other questions? You can see that we're willing to engage. Yes, this gentleman.
I had to
he
write back.
He doesn't do email.
What?
He doesn't do email.
No, I do email. I told him that I had no plans to be on the radio anymore. I thought you were going to ask me what happened to his romance. All right. I can't tell you.
Okay, yes. Did everybody hear the question? Good, and then I can answer it in any way I like. The question was, we talked about the way we were and are, how will we be? We will be ever more diverse. We will be more global. I think the thing we wanted to emphasize, and maybe this is a moment to close, is that Cornell has always produced a unique and distinctive brand of students and faculty, unique in the democratic character of this institution, in its openness, albeit expressed imperfectly. Cornell students will continue to be, as they have always been, extraordinarily bright and ambitious, and in our experience, nice, as are some alumni.